www.edu.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Former Charlotte Mayor Pat McCrory is approaching 100. He is at 100 days today in the governor's mansion. The first 100 days has become a performance benchmark for office holders. It signals the end of the honeymoon period and the beginning of a time when pundits and voters are looking for some of the promises made during the campaign to be fulfilled. So today we take stock of the first 100 days of Pat McCrory's time as governor, and we have invited three political observers to help in that effort. Dr. Michael Bitzer is chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Catawba College in Salisbury, a frequent go-to guy in the media and the person behind WFAE's political blog, The Party Line. Welcome back.
Morning.
Dr. Eric Heberlink has also become one of the area media's frequent expert guests. He was our go-to guy for the Democratic National Convention. He's associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte and co-chair of that university's 49er Democracy Experience. Morning, good to see you. Good morning and welcome. And Jim Morrill is a longtime political writer at the Charlotte Observer, and he's back with us again. Welcome.
Good to be here, Mike.
How did the first 100 days of a political candidate or a political office holder, his or her time in office, become the point at which we go, okay, let's take stock? How did that happen?
It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the New Deal. He rolled out many of his major New Deal initiatives and had a strongly Democratic Congress, and they pushed him through, and that was going to be their fulfilling of the mandate that the people gave them to get the economy rolling again during the New Deal. So that's become the yardstick that the media and political observers have applied to all presidents since then.
Did that happen for the Obama administration in the first term? Because he had a Democratic Congress, didn't he?
No, he took his time. And really, you know, the 100 days is misleading because Roosevelt's really the only one who's pulled it off. So everybody else looks like a slagger compared to that. So it's really an unfair comparison for presidents or, in this case, governors.
Because I was going to ask, is that a fair benchmark? Is it a fair yardstick to use in politics?
Well, it is, in the sense that you get this honeymoon period where the public says, all right, they're new, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They're cashing in on the promises they made during the election. And the opposition is more likely kind of to defer to those election results. So they do have this short window of opportunity. But, you know, problems are not easily solved in 100 days.
So FDR was a Democrat and he had a Democratic Congress. Pat McCrory is a Republican with a Republican legislature. Can we apply this yardstick to him in a fair manner?
Well, I think we can, but I mean, the question is what standards are you applying to? I mean, what is the benchmark? What are the expectations that we're having for him? Certainly, the Republicans laid out a very ambitious agenda: voter ID, the Medicaid expansion or lack thereof, issues of tax reforms. The budget is probably the single most important thing that state government is going to do in any legislative session. So there are a number of things. It's just, you know, a kind of arbitrary, it sounds nice, so let's judge them at 100 days. And mm-hmm. Really, the session is only halfway through. The General Assembly, I think, is going to go until June. So it's kind of a halfway point for them as well.
But were those things that you just mentioned, voter ID, Medicaid, tax reform, budget, were those candidate Pat McCrory's goals, or was that the legislature's goals?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I think that his goal, you know, he talked about tax reform, he talked about regulatory reform. He knew the General Assembly was going to go forward with some kind of voter ID, which he said he supports and presumably does. But the legislature came in guns blazing, ready to go. While Governor McCrory was still, in the words of Dr. Bitzer, finding his sea legs, you know, there's a steep learning curve,
right,
for somebody coming from Charlotte and from being a mayor
and who never had state and who never was in the legislature or had held state office.
Exactly, because I mean, typically the governor will be somebody who has worked their way up the yeah. ladder mm-hmm. Within state government, serving in the legislature, maybe as attorney general or lieutenant governor. McCrory just kind of came in, even though he had been exposed and worked with the legislature while he was mayor. That's a kind of different scenario to deal with.
Well, one of you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And as mayor of Charlotte, it's a technically a part-time position.
Right.
You're not actually governing the city. That's the city manager's job.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a different type of job that you're stepping into. So the learning curve is, you know, especially steep, that given that he doesn't have the Raleigh experience and his executive experience isn't of the same variety as
one
governor.
I don't know whether with one of the conversations we had prior to this program from the two political scientists or an article I read from you, Jim Morrill, that talked about Pat McCrory's transition team being in place and actively working before he was elected.
Yeah, yeah. He had people on the ground. I mean, I think people like John Lasseter from Charlotte, Ed McMahon from Charlotte, we're putting together a team. I mean, Governor McCrory was pretty careful not to jinx his election. That's what he said,
right,
by getting ahead of himself. But there were people who were working on his behalf to do that.
And he also brought in people, I think, that have the kind of connections that he needed to establish early on. Somebody like Fred Steen, who's a member of the State House, is now his legislative liaison. So he knows a lot of the players in the General Assembly and kind of can make that connection for the governor.
Since FDR set the standard here with his first 100 days in office back in the 1930s, late 30s, yeah. Can we apply that fairly once again to the office of governor, no matter who holds that office in North Carolina? What kind of a position is that? Is it a strong position? Is it a weak position in terms of the power that the governor wields to influence, shape, and demand policy?
North Carolina's governor has traditionally been one of the weaker governors in the United States. They've given the governor somewhat more power over the last couple decades. For example, the power to veto some legislation, which traditionally didn't have at all. So in that sense, you know, one of the themes I think we've seen out of Raleigh is that the legislature seems to be taking the lead, barreling full speed ahead, and the governor is kind of reacting to that. And that's not unusual in North Carolina, because that's kind of the structure that's been set up.
That's got to be really difficult when you think about what it takes, the chutzpah that it takes to put yourself up for public office, to be the man who would be king, and then to find out that the crown is worn by the people down the street.
Right, right. And remember, the legislature was in power for 2 years before he ever stepped into the executive mansion. So they had pretty much set their tone, had pretty much set their agenda, and they're just continuing on, you know, business as usual in terms of their perspective.
And Mayor McCrory had a couple of run-ins with the legislature when he was the mayor of Charlotte. I know he took a bus caravan. This is a legendary story. He took a bus caravan of people up there to the legislature and just popped in on people, and they did not appreciate it, to put it mildly. But that was a Democratic legislature. Are those people gone, or is he having to work with those people, and have they forgiven him?
Well, he's got Republican supermajorities in both the House and the Senate. So basically, it is they can do whatever they want. The Democrats can raise any kind of ruckus they can, but that's all they can basically do.
While he was mayor of Charlotte, Pat McCrory championed some fairly progressive causes for a Republican, such as light rail. A lot of conservatives were very opposed to light rail up until almost the moment that it opened, but I don't think he ever wavered in his support for the Lynx. Some of those who saw him as a progressive Republican in Charlotte have expressed disappointment. And Eric, you say that McCrory took more conservative positions early in the 2012 campaign than many expected to ward off strong challenges in the GOP primary. During the election, he did not articulate much of a policy agenda at all because Walter Dalton, the lieutenant governor at that time, was so far behind in the race, so he could fuzz over his moderate image as Charlotte mayor and the more conservative stances he took earlier in the campaign. So has he changed his spots from his time as mayor here, or are his true colors now coming out?
It's unclear. You know, politicians always adapt to their audience, to their voting bloc. So as Charlotte mayor, you're running as a Republican in a city that's trending Democratic, so it certainly doesn't hurt to have at least a few issues on which you can appeal to independents and Democrats, and environmentalism is a good one to choose. But then that, as you pointed out, created some difficulty for him in the Republican primary running for governor, that they didn't want a big government urban mayor, so he's had to find ways of mollifying the conservative base, And I think that's part of the dynamic that we're seeing in these first months as mayor.
When you're running,
or as governor.
And the people down east call you too yuppie, as I think they did because he was from Charlotte and he's an urban mayor, that's one thing to kind of play that down a little bit and maybe drop the G's on the end of your INGs, which he does a lot now. He's going to do that. But now he is the governor. And he is the incumbent governor. So in 4 years, when he inevitably runs again, he has the power of incumbency. Does he still have to play that role? Meet with people down east? Does he have to be the good old boy or the less than yuppie boy to win again?
Well, I don't think stylistically, but he has to show potential challengers, potential donors, activists on the Republican side that he's with them, so he doesn't have to worry about that problem. And I think that's what we saw early on between 2008 when he lost the governor's race and the primaries this time when he seemed to make special effort to ward off a primary challenge.
Well, look, he's got a different constituency now, period. You know, he's representing the state. I think he's still trying to figure out how to do that, frankly. He's taken some positions that seem more conservative to people here, and I don't think the jury's out yet on all the things that he's going to do. I mean, there's going to be some legislation that's going to come before him that he's going to have to decide whether to, you know, rubber stamp it or veto it or what.
Well, you've known him for a long time as mayor of Charlotte, and maybe were you writing for the Observer Politics when he was on
City Council? City Council campaign.
So you've known him for a long time. Would you say he's changed, or has he changed? Is he revealing himself as the person he always was? What's your take on it?
I don't think he's changed a lot, to be honest with you. I think he's always been fairly conservative deep down. But again, you know, the constituencies are different. I mean, you remember the days when he refused to greet the gay pride parade. You know, refused to give out a city welcome for them. So he's been conservative in some ways, but I don't know if progressive is the right word, but at least more moderate in other ways. And I think he's still basically like that.
He seems much more pragmatic, I think.
Yeah.
I
mean,
In his time in office, I think, you know, as mayor, you know, he recognized that there is some good that government can do, the transportation issues, the Coliseum,
the arena
issues as well. And so I think he's kind of carrying that over. We have to remember that between his first run for governor and his eventual election, we had this thing called the Tea Party insurgency. Mm-hmm. And that truly impacted North Carolina, particularly in the Republican Party. People that made up that kind of insurgency really had a very strong conservative bent to it. And so he's kind of having to react to not just his party, but broadly the state as well.
Well, for the people outside of Charlotte who didn't know him well or who knew of him because he was the mayor of Charlotte in the great state of Mecklenburg, for which they have great distaste. And maybe they went into the voting booth and pulled the lever for him because they are Republicans and he was a Republican, and so they just gritted their teeth and did it. Are they happy with him today?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. I say that because there's a new Elon poll that's out today that shows he's got a higher approval rating, which is below 50%, but just barely below 50%, which
it's
is
higher than the president.
Higher than the president, higher than the General Assembly, higher than any member of Congress here.
Yeah.
And it's his approvals are double his disapproval. So you have to say, I think people like that to the extent they're paying attention.
And he's been doing a lot of traveling. People are getting to know him around the state. And he's a very nice person when you get to know him personally.
Yeah, you know, that affability, I don't think you can overestimate the importance of that. Yeah. You see that with his dealings with the legislature. He's been over to the legislative building more times already, I think, probably than his predecessors have by this point. And he's having breakfast with them.
We'll take a look at some of the things that he's done or wants to do or hasn't done and more as we go through this hour with Dr. Michael Bitzer and Dr. Eric Heberlig and Jim Morrill. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and PNC Wealth Management, PNC's financial professionals helping clients achieve financial goals for over 160 years. For details, Mike York is available, 704-686-2010. And Carolina Raptor Center introducing the Owl Forest, a nature notebook, a new exhibit featuring five species of owls, and the observations and drawings of our visitors in our nature sketchbook studio. Details, carolinaraptorcenter.org. South Carolina's Carlisle Floyd is a living legend in the world of opera. Since the 50s, he has composed some of this country's greatest works, from Susanna in the 1950s to Willie Stark in the 80s to Cold Sassy Tree in 2000. He will join us, along with opera tenor Anthony Dean Griffey, to talk about opera and his compositions and other things tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, placing armed guards in schools around the country. Just one idea contained in proposed gun legislation, the effects on students and teachers.
Join us for that conversation on the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-supported public radio, or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Eric Heberlig with UNC Charlotte, Dr. Michael Bitzer with Catawba College, and Jim Morrill with the Charlotte Observer, talking about the first 100 days of Governor Pat McCrory. One of the first things that he did upon taking office was to give pay raises to his cabinet members over what their predecessors in the Purdue administration were making. Was that a necessary move? Did that set a tone of sorts for his gubernatorial leadership? Was it a wise move? Was it necessary?
He would say it was. The issue, that issue, along with the gaffe on the Bill Bennett show and an appointee to the pre-K education program that had come out against pre-K education, you know, I think those were momentary blips in stumbles that any first-term governor is going to have to get through in order to get settled into the office. And I don't think they were monumental on the grand scheme of things. Democrats, of course, howled about it and raised concerns in saying, you know, he went around saying there's no new money in the state budget, but he's giving pay raises to his cabinet secretaries. It kind of – the optics does not look well in that regard. But I think they were momentary blips in the grand scheme of things.
But given the state's economic condition and the fact that they still want to cut things and they're being very tight in the pocketbook out of necessity because of the recession. And is that a way to start off as a governor by giving pay raises to people? I mean, probably negligible in the scheme of things in terms of how much money the state has to deal with every year. But was that a good thing, a bad thing?
Yeah, politically? I mean, in terms of messaging, it makes it a little harder. Okay. But I think Mike's right. People have forgotten about it already.
I think he did have trouble getting people to go to Raleigh for some of these jobs because, you know, you're asking people to come out of private sector jobs where their salaries are probably a lot more than the state cabinet secretary is making. He's had a hard time.
Yeah, we do this at all levels of government, and it strikes me as odd. The president of the United States makes $400,000 a year. If he were doing this in a private company, his salary would be unfathomable because he's the president of the United States. I would say he'd be making what GE's president makes at least,
which
would be multi-millions of dollars in the double digits, maybe triple digits.
Yeah.
Will when he leaves office.
Well, that seems to be the path from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue or Capitol Hill to K Street. He also repealed Governor Perdue's call for a committee to recommend a slate of judges for appointment by the governor. Now explain this, because this was not Governor Perdue did not want to take away judge elections and let the governor appoint all the judges. These are for people who were elected but who left office and had to be replaced. Is that correct?
Vacancies.
And
yes,
she was exactly. She changed her mind on this after she did it.
She did. And so there were some charges of, you know, you're not following your own rules that you laid out. Mm-hmm. When a judicial spot came open due to a vacancy or due to a death, the governor has the power to appoint, and that individual then stands in the next election. What Governor Perdue had was basically a group of individuals who would recommend judges when there were vacancies, and then she would basically pick from one of those recommended individuals. Late in her term, after she was a lame duck after the election, she basically threw that out and started appointing people who she wanted to. Remember, the Republicans are in control of the legislative branch. They're in control of the gubernatorial branch. They're basically in control of the Supreme Court, but below the Supreme Court are hundreds of Court of Appeals and District Court judges and Superior Court judges. And that's where the Republicans want to start working their way into those governmental positions.
And this was an executive order that he repealed from a Democratic governor to a Republican governor. We've had a succession of Democratic governors, so I'm just curious, how unusual is it for a governor to repeal the previous governor's executive orders?
It happens all the time.
Does it really? Even with Democrats?
Happens at the presidential level as well.
Okay. Yeah. One of the more controversial items that has been winding its way through the legislature has been the voter ID law. Governor McCrory supports it. By offering his support, is he simply pushing or polishing his GOP credentials? Or does he really believe that voter fraud is a big problem in North Carolina?
Well, you'd have to think that he thinks it is. He at least thinks it's big enough to address with a voter ID. And this is sort of Republican dogma these days. I mean, I think they have to – most everybody does that. Now, I think what the governor has said he would do is try to mollify it a little bit. In other words, not do the most hard-edged voter ID requirement that some legislators had talked about a couple years ago, but do some kind of a compromise, which apparently is what they're working on now, which gives you flexibility in the IDs that you're able to use.
How much influence or power does he have over the final outcome of that? Can he just urge them, the legislature, to do certain things a certain way? Or can he say, it has to be this way, you will do it my way? He can't do that, can he?
No, he can't, and he hasn't. And I think he's trying his best to use what power he has as a governor to work with them.
And I think part of the equation is also what the legislative leaders want to do, where they want to compromise. I think a key dynamic is the rumors that Speaker Tillis is thinking about running for Senate. So much of the more radical legislation that's gone through to this point has been the Senate, and the House is slowing things down, and arguably that's because Speaker Tillis doesn't want to have to defend many of these things if he's running for Senate. Mm. So you may have a combination of McCrory with an incentive to appeal to the broad general election constituency in North Carolina, moderating things, and Speaker Tillis, who has his eye on the same constituency statewide, running for Senate, putting the brakes on some of the more controversial legislation.
And let's throw in one more key actor, Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, who is also rumored to be eyeing that Republican nomination to challenge Kay Hagan. He's come out with some very aggressive, very socially conservative, very conservative policy initiatives, and I'm going to be interested to see the dynamic between those two legislative leaders, Speaker Tillis, Senator Berger, and see how they work out. Does the governor then step in after the dust has settled between those two and basically sign whatever it is? I think the legislature has very much more taken the aggressive lead on a lot of things.
I think the governor is already closer, at least perceived to be closer to Speaker Tillis from Cornelius. They've known each other from Mecklenburg County. And the governor also had a fundraiser, a large fundraiser for Tillis a month ago at Myers Park Country Club. And there's a lot more give and take between those two than there is between McCrory and Senator Berger.
Let's go back to the idea that Pat McCrory was a progressive mayor. I think that most people would say that, and only if he was a Republican, and he was a Republican. So did we consider him to be progressive as mayor because of his support of transit and projects like the arena and their economic development potential? Or were there other reasons we thought?
Well, I think those are our main ones. But don't forget, with transit, it wasn't just a question of trains. It was a question of development along the transit corridors.
Right.
It was planned development. It was, you know, increase the density along the corridors, and that the city should have an active role in putting forth policies that do that.
And these were projects that were also heavily supported by the Charlotte business community. So it didn't hurt him to have issues that could both be appealing to moderate and Democratic voters and appeal to the Chamber of Commerce base.
So for a man who supported the Lynx Blue Line, mostly because of its economic development potential, which has proven to be true, was it out of character for him to voice his opposition to Mayor Fox's desire to have a trolley down the middle of Trade Street from Bates Ford Road to Eastland Mall, given the fact that the argument is being put forth that that, too, is an economic development project?
I don't think it's out of character. I think when he was mayor, he vetoed some legislation or some city council business that some funding for the streetcar. And he and Fox, even when Fox was on city council, butted heads on that issue a little bit. So I don't think it's really inconsistent for him to do that. And I think he was trying to give advice. According to him, he was trying to give advice to the city about dealing with emphasizing the streetcar and hoping for the legislature to give money to the Blue Line extension, the light rail extension.
In other words, don't ask for both.
He was trying to inject a little realism into the debate, I think, which maybe has turned out to be true.
Actually. And funding issues.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the catch for him, though, has been he was perceived as kind of interfering in Charlotte's business in that respect. But then when it comes to the airport, he said, "Oh, I'm governor. I can't get involved."
Yes, that was my next. Things. That was my next question. Which you know, because if he's going to come down against the streetcar or say, "Hey, no, you shouldn't be doing this," when they asked him about the airport and the airport authority, which is being pushed by local legislators in Raleigh, but they're from the local area, he said, "That's a what is he? What did he say?
It's
that
a local
a,
bill.
Factions,
local factions are doing this. is that?" Why would he do that? Well, he knows he was the mayor of Charlotte when the city and the city ran the airport since its inception. He surely knows what this means to the city. Why would he not say something?
That's a good question. You know, if he were mayor, I think he would be saying
he'd be on the side of Mayor Fox on this. If he was the mayor,
well, I think that's part of the dynamic that we were talking about earlier. That he has a broader non-Charlotte constituency to appeal to now. That I think one of the fears that non-Charlotte people have is that if you have a mayor from Charlotte, they're going to take all the state money and direct it to the city. So he has to show the non-Charlotte people that he's not not governing on Charlotte's behalf.
But this has nothing to do with money, supposedly.
Well, it has to do with power.
Yeah, power, yeah. Is how much of it has to do with the fact that it's a Republican-run government in Raleigh, but this is a Democratic city? Because in Raleigh, the Republican legislature is going after a pet project of their Democratic city government,
right.
The Dorothea Dix
Hospital.
Hospital yeah. Park, whatever they're going to call it up there.
And they're also going after the Asheville water bill, water administration, and making it more regional as well. You know, there seems to be a real tension between the Republican legislature and primarily urban, Democratic-oriented urban areas. And urban areas have been trending much more Democratic. But this Republican legislature, for all the talk of we want power to be, you know, decentralized, we want it closest to the people, they've been going after some big issues.
What's the issue in Wake County with Dorothea Dix? What's the situation there?
Well, Governor Perdue signed a lease for the property, giving the city of Raleigh a pretty good deal on the property. And Republicans in the legislature basically said she gave it away. She gave away the farm, and they want to renegotiate the lease, which bothers a lot of people in Raleigh. Now, the governor said last week that he's trying to negotiate some kind of compromise to make it a win-win for both the city and the state.
Mm-hmm. Because the argument the city has up there is that, hey, you guys signed a contract. This is a binding document, and now you're going to break the contract?
Yeah.
And that's happening around the country, these kinds of things, not just in North Carolina?
I don't know about outside, but you know, the tension has always been Democratic urban areas versus a typical Republican legislature.
So because Pat McCrory has said that the airport issue is a fight between local factions, one of the local factions is Bob Russo and others from the Matthews area and other parts
in Charlotte.
Yeah, but they're from this region and they're in the legislature. Mm-hmm. So is he trying to just tamp down all of that and not get in a contentious battle with that part of the legislature because it might upset them if he favored with the city of Charlotte, if he sided with the city of Charlotte? Is it politics? Is he just trying to keep things
level? Definitely
politics. but we don't know who else he's hearing from in Charlotte. I mean, this whole airport thing has been kind of foggy. The origins of it have been kind of foggy from the get-go. And what we do know is that there's a small group of businessmen you know, Stan Campbell, maybe Johnny Harris, people like that, who are favoring an authority. And we don't know who the governor is listening to completely on that.
He has also, as I understand it, resisted state support for the renovations
yes.
to Panther Stadium. As mayor, he worked tirelessly to attract business to Charlotte and keep business in Charlotte. And as governor, he has voiced his concern about the need for more economic development and attracting business to the state. Why would he be against giving support for remodeling a stadium for the state's only NFL team, which is arguably, if you're going to support sports at all, that's the one to support?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to the larger constituency again, and he's looking at state
but,
money.
But
and
they are the Carolina Panthers, not the Charlotte Panthers.
Yeah, but the perception might be that, you know, he's favoring Charlotte. And he was asked to give $60 million from the state to the Panthers. That's what they asked of him. They asked the legislature for something else. But, mm-hmm. you know, in a tight budget year, it would have been hard. He would have been defending that decision for a long time.
Yeah, this is setting up some interesting dynamics in terms of if this deal doesn't come through or if they have to go with a lower level, you know, is this going to put the future of the Carolina Panthers in jeopardy? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what will a new owner after the post-Jerry Richardson tenure, what will they do?
Well, there are a lot of people who think this is a ridiculous request, that we have multi-million-dollar people here asking for money for mm-hmm. stuff that's going to enrich them and make them more profitable, and that we shouldn't do it at all. We should turn it down. But on the other hand, this is the NFL. It's the crown jewel in the Carolina sports pantheon. If we lost them, what would that mean to the state economically and in terms of prestige?
I think it would be a big hit in terms of pride. I think it's overestimated the amount of economic impact it has. But you have sports teams because when your Chamber of Commerce and trying to attract businesses to come here, they want to see you have the things that major cities have.
The toys.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Museums, arts, good schools, sports teams that their employees are going to want to move there. And that's the different perspective that, you know, a mayor is going to have. A mayor wants to make sure that you have all those assets in the city where a governor, well, you know, it's not as big a deal for the state as
well. Once
all.
Again, we're not the New York, we're not the St. Louis Cardinals. It's the Carolina Panthers. It's not the Charlotte Panthers.
The Atlanta Falcons.
That's right. I mean, you know, I mean.
Well, you talked about the suburban versus urban dynamic earlier. You know, most of the jobs that the people in the suburb work at are in the city. They come in to see the Panthers in the city. They take advantage of all the city assets, yet they don't want to pay the taxes in the city,
right.
Which is why they live out there. And that's part of the tension.
I guess what I'm getting at, once again, is that he has to do a very delicate dance here, because I'm sure he still has feelings about Charlotte and feelings for Charlotte and has a lot of ties to Charlotte. On the other hand, he's now the governor of North Carolina, and there's this animosity, traditional animosity between the rest of the state and us for whatever reason. It's there, the jealousy, whatever it is. And he has to walk this very fine wire. Could we end up getting the short end of the stick more often than not, because he's trying not to play favoritism?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Well, it's not just with the governor, though. I mean, it's with the legislature, too. I mean, we have the legislature is more urban this year than it ever has been. Mecklenburg County has a larger percentage of the entire legislature than it's ever had. And yet, Charlotte's having all these problems getting things that it wants. Not only Charlotte, but other cities.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the first 100 days of Pat McCrory as governor of North Carolina. We're going to come back and talk about a lot of other issues as well with Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Catawba College in Salisbury, Dr. Eric Heberling, associate professor and co-chair of the Political Science Department at UNC Charlotte, and Jim Morrill, a longtime political writer for the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC's Small Business Center, featuring its new one-day class, Bidding and Managing Federal Contracts, on May 2nd. Details at 704-330-4223. And Eco-Modernism, a turnkey modern kitchen design service featuring IKEA and Besch cabinets for individual homeowners and multi-unit markets. Information at eco-modernism.com. The growing presence of police in schools, the topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show. Placing armed guards in schools around the country is just one idea contained in proposed gun legislation, and Diane and her guests will discuss the effects on students and teachers in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. Join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back in about 30 seconds.
Peter Sagal here. It is so frustrating that I've been doing the show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, for so long, and I don't know what you all look like. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to simulcast our show live from New York City on May 2nd to theaters all over the country. And I want you to come to the theater. I want you to stare at the screen. And if I peer into the camera hard enough, I think I'll be able to see you. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, live in theaters on May 2nd. Carl Castle and a bucket of buttered popcorn. Come on. Order your tickets now at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the first 100 days of Pat McCrory's governorship in Raleigh. And I promoted Dr. Eric Heberlig in coming out of the last break. I don't want to do – quite often guests on this program get promoted by me, and I think deservedly so. But he's the co-chair of the 49er Democracy Experience and not the Department of Political Science at UNC Charlotte. But he may be by the time he gets back to work. Governor McCrory went to Raleigh saying essentially that North Carolina wasn't working and that he wanted to find long-term solutions to the state's problems. Was he right? Why did he feel that the state wasn't working as well as it used to, evidently?
Well, look at the unemployment rate, much higher than the national average. Concerns about, you know, where revenues are going to be coming from to fund a $20 billion state budget. I think one of the big things he's been focusing on is this branding effort, you know, trying to get North Carolina's name and image more positively out there. You see states oftentimes having their own commercials, running ads. And so I think, you know, one of his emphasis is going to be focusing on getting, as one of the three E's he's got in his State of the State address, efficiency in government. And part of that is, you know, getting the word out there, getting the branding out there.
Efficiency is one of the E's.
Education.
Education.
And the economy.
Economy. Just a few days ago, speaking of the economy, I guess, he announced a plan to pursue a partnership for prosperity to change the way the state fosters growth. And he wants to create a separate nonprofit corporation to center economic development functions in the state. Is this an original idea, or is this something that's being patterned on something that other states are doing?
It has been tried in other states, and I really don't know how well it's worked out. Or how long it's been in effect, but in states with Republican governors, Indiana, Florida, they have this idea. And the idea is to get the public private sector more involved. It would create a board that would oversee, giving out incentive money and attracting businesses.
Now, who does that now? Is that the Department of Commerce?
Yes.
Why do we need a nonprofit corporation, another layer of bureaucracy, to do what the state has traditionally done for itself?
That's what some people are asking, but I think he would say that, you know, the private sector is more efficient at things like this, and he wants to get a public-private partnership.
So who would run this?
Whoever they appoint. I think
who would make the appointments?
Presumably the governor and or the legislative leaders.
And would these people be compensated?
Presumably so.
What would happen to the Department of Commerce?
It would have fewer responsibilities. I think that the main advantage that this private partnership does is that by putting it outside of state government to an extent, it gives them more flexibility, or at least that's how McCrory and allies are touting this.
Could this be described as a move to downsize government in a way?
Sure.
But if you're just taking the job away from the government and sticking it over in a public-private partnership, is that really downsizing? Aren't you just – the job still has to be done. It's still being done. It's just not being done by people we elect.
You potentially have the more flexibility. I mean, you're not dealing with state bureaucracy, state regulations, state control over the employees, and you get a little potentially more – you know, can you cut deals in private in a more private setting than necessarily in a more public setting?
Well, that's disturbing to a lot of people because they want more openness in government. Sure. They're taking this out of government so they can shut it down and take the daylight out of it. Is that a good thing for a democracy?
It does remove a lot of accountability. But if the business deals are best conducted in private, that's what they're going to argue.
And most are.
It dissuades business from coming here if they can't privately make the arrangements that they need to make.
And, of course, the idea that you can be nimble and react more quickly because you don't have to jump through all the governmental red tape and hoops and the bureaucracy of the government that can slow things down, that's a good thing in some situations. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you are avoiding regulations that were put in place for a reason, is that a good thing? Does it counteract each other? Does it cancel each other out?
Well, you know, the state, I think, has been pretty nimble on some economic development things, including in the governor's term. I mean, don't forget MetLife, which was like the biggest economic development announcement almost ever, at least in anybody's memory in North Carolina, which happened in March. 2,300 jobs to Charlotte and Raleigh, and that was a product of the Department of Commerce.
And how did they do that without closing the doors and keeping the negotiations private, like this new organization could do? They obviously accomplished this.
They found a way.
And it started under the previous administration.
Mm-hmm. So where does this stand at the moment? Do we know?
Well, it's a proposal from the governor, and it's still got to be approved by the legislature or funded by the legislature. So it's still a work in progress. And they don't have the details all worked out yet either.
Would the money come from the Commerce Department, or would this be new money being put toward this authority, or do we know?
I don't know that we know, presumably from the Commerce Department.
Yeah. Okay. Put your headphones on for a second. We'll take a call from Debbie in Wadesboro on a completely different topic. Welcome, Debbie.
Hey, thank you. This is real important to me. The fracking, I understand that they are doing this fast-track fracking, this SB-76. And it really does ignore the fact that I here in Anson County am on the list to be fracked, and I'm on well water. I have read and heard and seen so much negative information about this, what they're doing in Pennsylvania, and the big trucks running up and down all the time, the earthquakes, the water usage, the chemicals, the animals losing their hair, people getting sick. We're already struggling with air pollution, and our roads are a mess from the tree traffic. So I want to know what these gentlemen know about this fast-track fracking, and can't they just hold off a few years and see how it goes in other states before they do this to us?
Is this the legislature doing this, or is this the governor in favor of this?
I don't know. I think the governor is all for it. That's the impression that I get.
Okay.
And if it should pass, he's going to go ahead and say that's good. It's good for business.
Which one of you knows the answer to that question?
Well, I think she's right. I think it's on the fast track in the legislature, and there was a lot of a momentum for it. It was passed a couple of years ago, and now it's on its way to getting implemented. And the governor has said that he would sign it because in the campaign, he called for new energy resources, new exploration, both offshore oil drilling and fracking, and whether the market is ready for it or not is a different question. But
Debbie, thank you. We'll keep our eyes on it for you, but thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Governor McCrory wants to transform education, yet Wake County school officials are warning that the governor's budget could cause them to lose funding for 400 teacher assistant positions. In fact, his budget would cut funding for teacher assistants in second and third grade across the state to the tune of $117 million. At the same time, he wants to give a 1% pay raise to all of the teachers in the state. So does it make sense to cut teaching assistants in the second and third grade when you also support early childhood education? I mean, this is not early childhood education, but really it is. And if you lose a child by the third or fourth grade, you've pretty much lost them.
Well, that's really the trade-offs that they're making when they're saying we're not going to have any new revenue. That means any time you spend more money on some other topic, it has to come from somewhere else. So I think it's, you know, an arguable decision, but that's the type of situation you put yourself into.
And when you pledge not to raise taxes and you're hoping that the economy is going to get a little bit better, mm-hmm. maybe there might be some increases in revenues. But it is certainly, as Eric said, basically it's a zero-sum game. You give to one side, you got to take away from another part of the ledger. And that's the balancing act that they're having
but
to do.
But education is something that keeps being touted by politicians at all levels about how important it is to have good schools and have a highly educated workforce. Because in the final analysis, we're just all worker bees.
Sure, sure. And the state budget, over half of it goes to education, K-12 and higher ed. So this is the number one priority that the state of North Carolina tends to emphasize.
And I think the first bill that the governor signed had to do with education and making vocational education mm-hmm. more accessible and more practical.
Yes, and he also raised some eyebrows when he talked about colleges, and it doesn't matter. What was his quote about butts in the seats? He wanted to make sure they had jobs when the butts got out of the seats.
Right. You wanted funded based on jobs, not on people in class.
That didn't go over well in the halls of academe, did it?
No, because it sounded like he wanted to turn us into job training programs rather than institutes of higher learning, where people would learn how to have the flexibility to think and communicate and do the jobs of the future. You know, he wanted the people to train to be welders.
Did he just not communicate it well, or is that exactly what he wants? Does he want people to go to UNC Charlotte or UNC Chapel Hill and make sure they'll get a job when they're – and not be philosophy majors?
I think he's hearing from the business community that there are some jobs that they're having trouble filling because they don't have people with the right type of skills. So he's legitimately saying, how do we create an educational system where we do have a match between the skills that are being advocated mm. at the educational level that can get people jobs. But I don't think he meant to say, although that's what he said, that it's really an either-or type thing.
That was the Bill Bennett conversation you
right.
were talking about, right?
Yeah.
He also proposed cutting more than $135 million from the University of North Carolina system next year. What kind of impact would that have on what is considered one of the best public universities in the country, and why would he want to do that?
Well, I think the real issue is that it's on top of the major cuts we've already had over the past 3 years. So our faculties are already down. They're being hired away by other states. So it's difficult to maintain that branding, that national reputation when you're losing your faculty. There are already majors that are telling people, don't be our major. We don't have the classes for you. You're looking at bigger class sizes. And they're, except for out-of-state students who they want to jack up tuition rates for them, capping them for in-state students. So if you cut the budget and say you can't get additional revenues from elsewhere, there's you know, not a whole lot to do except apportion the pain.
Hmm. How many people in the legislature are behind him on this? Do you know?
Well, I think most of them probably are in terms of cutting UNC spending, like you said. I mean, they'd cut it a couple years ago, and there's no expectation they wouldn't do it again.
At the same time, he's proposing $63 million over 2 years for the UNC system strategic plan, whatever that is, plus the 1% raise for teachers statewide. He wants to hire 1,800 more teachers over 2 years, has proposed spending $43 million on digital learning. If he's able to get these initiatives through the legislature along with some of the other things on his wish list, will he have strengthened education, or is it going to be a zero-sum game with the cuts at the university level?
Well, politically, you know, there are a lot more kids and parents who are affected by K-12 education. So as a political statement, it makes a lot more sense to appeal to them. And, you know, the university professors will whine about anything anyway. So.
We have a web comment from Gary. See how far big money has corrupted our nation? For many years, I have occasionally heard America compared to the Roman Empire and the reasons why it eventually ceased to exist. It seems that money and pleasure are our primary goals, the same factors attributed to the Roman Empire. Governor McCrory hasn't offered anything we haven't heard before. For many reasons, none of those ideas worked in the past. Why should they now? He would literally have to change human nature, and that's impossible. I don't know which ideas he's referring to in that comment, but I just threw it out there for what it's worth. That's from Gary. Governor McCrory has also outlined a framework for Medicaid reform in an effort to improve care, he says, customer service, and results for the young, the elderly, the disabled, the mentally ill, and low-income families. How will this work, and how is the proposal for a, quote, partnership for a healthy North Carolina, end quote, being viewed?
Well, I think that it what he's proposed in terms of Medicaid reform involves putting the system in the hands of managed care providers, letting some managed care companies, including some for-profit companies, lobby for beneficiaries or own customers. In terms of how it's being viewed, I know that the North Carolina Medical Society doesn't think it's a great idea. There's already a company or nonprofit that takes care of Medicaid patients in North Carolina, which has just gotten an award a week or two ago. So, we'll see how that fares over in the General Assembly.
And yet, he urged the legislature to slow down before rejecting federal help to expand Medicaid under the, I guess, Obamacare, the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act. But the state, hasn't the state rejected that along with every other southern state?
Yeah, he had a chance to diverge with that, but he didn't. And I think
explain that. Why, if the government's going to pick up the cost, the extra cost of Medicaid, and give that money, I guess, to the states to support that program, why would states turn it down?
Well, part of what the governor had said was in not taking the federal partnership was that he wanted to get the state's Medicaid system fixed to begin with. Mm-hmm. So I think this process that he's working on, you know, and my understanding also is that the federal government will come in and set up the program. So it's not going to be a federal-state relationship. It's going to be a federal program.
So I have a minute left, and since we're talking about the first 100 days, he's been lauded for his hard work since coming to Raleigh, Governor McCrory. How would you assess what he's been able to accomplish in the first 100 days? Above average, below average, average?
Average.
Average, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it, but,
you're
busy.
A reporter. You can't.
Yeah, I do that.
And he's expected later this week to release some sort of transportation proposal. Do we have any idea what might be in that?
You know, all I know is I think it's going to involve a long-term transportation plan for the state like he did in Charlotte.
Jim Morrill is a longtime political writer for the Charlotte Observer. Dr. Eric Heberling is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNC Charlotte and co-chair of the 49er Democracy Experience, despite his desires to be the co-chair of the department. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Catawba College. Thank you all for being here.
My pleasure.